Actually, of course, there isn't any logical necessity at all that systems of relations, civilizations, go through precisely the same life cycle as the individuals in them. It's possible, unfortunately, to build a building which will long outlast you, that will not go through a similar life cycle to your own. In the case of many works of modern architecture, this is very unfortunate. It would be perhaps much better if there were a definite growth, decay, and death pattern related to these buildings, but the fact is that human beings can create things that don't have a similar pattern to their own lives. Indeed, the effort of man and civilization seems to be to create things of permanence that won't suffer in the same way as the individual does himself. What about Toynbee's own view? Toynbee isolates a series of civilizations. He follows the same kind of approach that Spengler does, but on a much more sophisticated and careful basis. He isolates some 34 civilizations. The number of these varies according to the period at which Toynbee worked. He eventually, in his Reconsiderations volume at the end of A Study of History, modifies the number of civilizations, but these civilizations are all determined by a single principle or lifestyle. For example, Cynic civilization, S-I-N-I-C, not C-Y-N-I-C, of course, Cynic or Oriental civilization is determined principally by the notion of the family, by the familial theme that runs through it. Toynbee argues that you can't understand the history of France, for example, without understanding the history of Germany. You can't understand either of them in modern times without understanding the history of England and of America. All of these interlock. But until very recent times, you could most definitely study Chinese civilization without having to appeal to German history. In other words, it is possible to find certain main themes and certain larger patterns in history which can be isolated and dealt with. These civilizations, Toynbee feels, can be understood by way of keys. One key is the principle of challenge and response. For Toynbee, each civilization faces certain particular problems, and these particular problems are crucial and have got to be dealt with. They create the challenges, and the type of response determines the continued existence of the civilization. If a civilization responds properly to its challenges, it can continue. If it doesn't, it will collapse. Civilizations don't have to die. They die only when the challenges are not adequately responded to. And the second key for Toynbee is the notion of religion. Toynbee feels that a civilization gives rise to a religion, and the religion, at the time of the collapse of the civilization, carries on its fundamental theme and implants this in a new situation. For Toynbee, civilizations are the womb in which religions are born. This stress on religion is much stronger in the later volumes of Toynbee's Study of History than in the earlier volumes. It really is stressed as a fundamental theme as you get into the last six volumes of the total set. Toynbee is much humbler than the other philosophers of history that we've talked about. Spengler, in his preface to The Decline of the West, says in a typically mild Germanic fashion, "I am not stating a philosophy of history, I am stating the philosophy of history." Now, Toynbee is not that kind of person. He says, for example, that if his work can act as a stimulant to further investigation that will modify this kind of vast conception of history, then he will have done his work well. What about Toynbee's viewpoint? Let me just go over several of the criticisms of Toynbee that have been presented. In light of what we've just said, that Toynbee is not offering his position as a dogmatic position in quite the same sense as these other views. As Toynbee himself admits, he has used Hellenic civilization as a model or pattern for the interpretation of other civilizations. Hellenic civilization happened to be his own particular historical specialty. Now, there isn't really any compelling reason why you ought to start Hellenic. And this has particularly bothered some people who have operated with other civilizations and who have not found the Hellenic model particularly useful. His interest in obtaining a general synoptic view of human history has meant that in his treatment of particular historical events, they have been drawn into Procrustean beds as well. For example, Myron Gilmore, in his magnificent treatment of the Renaissance, has pointed out how Toynbee has misunderstood certain fundamental characteristics of the model particularly useful. His interest in obtaining a general synoptic view of human history has meant that in his treatment of particular historical events, they have been drawn into Procrustean beds as well. For example, Myron Gilmore, in his magnificent treatment of the Renaissance, has pointed out how Toynbee has misunderstood certain fundamental characteristics of the Renaissance by having to throw this into a similar pattern to other material that he's analyzed. Dray of the University of Toronto, one of the foremost philosophers of history of our time, has talked about Toynbee's creeping determinism as illustrated by what Dray calls hardening of the categories. Hardening of the categories is the intellectual equivalent of hardening of the arteries. And it works like this. Something is stated tentatively in the early volumes of a study of history, and then in the later volumes, other things are built on these tentative statements as if they had been demonstrated. See? So you gradually get a house that is built a bit on sand. And then, as Gerhard Masur said in his review of volume 12 of A Study of History, in the very excellent and detailed review in the American Historical Review, Toynbee still believes that the idea of challenge and response constitutes a magical key to the why and how of human creativity. But is it not, after all, little more than a formal principle, like Hegel's dialectic, which cannot provide us with a canon of interpretation? Few people would deny that there are challenges in history and that they've got to be responded to. But how far exactly does this get us? It is so terribly British of him to put it that way, because the Britisher always thinks of life as a challenge, in there and at it, men. And one doesn't always ask, you know, where you're going and why you're doing it, and the larger philosophical issues seem irrelevant to the game that's being played. In a real sense, Toynbee's study of history takes place on an Eton playing field. When Toynbee analyzes religion, some peculiar things occur. His view is that all religions are basically saying the same thing. He talks about the possibility of the higher religions fusing eventually, and the higher religions, of course, are classed according to his own concept of them. He does not include Judaism among the higher religions and is thoroughly disliked by the people who operate with an Israeli perspective. It so happens that Toynbee's early work was done very largely in Arab areas, and Toynbee is very strongly pro-Arab in the current political conflict, as I'm sure you know, and he doesn't stick Israel into the higher religious category, but considers this as a kind of a variant of Christianity. But he places Islam in that category, and he considers these religions all to be saying basically the same thing, and finally they're going to arrive at a synthesis. The problem with this, of course, is that it's a kind of neo-Mahayana Buddhist spirituality which ignores the distinctives of these positions. It was Edgar Sheffield Brightman at Boston University a generation ago who said that a universe in which both Christian Science and Roman Catholicism can be true is a cosmic madhouse. And that kind of tough-mindedness in the face of differing religious positions is something that Toynbee, unfortunately, does not operate with. All right, what is the common problem with these philosophies of history? The common problem, which should be painfully obvious from our discussion, is what is generally termed the human predicament. Now, the human predicament can be defined in broad terms or narrow terms. In broad terms, it's the fact that the telephone always rings when you're in the bathtub. But that's the broader perspective on it. The narrower perspective on the human predicament is that human beings are caught in their limited situations. The bathtub being only one of them. They're caught in their limited situations, and their perspective is held down to the situation where they are. Let me illustrate this by this peculiar diagram here, which is only in process of development. It's going to be developed, not dialectically, but it's going to be developed, and I have entitled it The Human Predicament. Here we have human history, and I have drawn a line here up the chart at the point of the mid-19th century. This is the Hegel and Marx point, and there we have two figures. They represent Hegel and Marx. Marx is smiling, and Hegel is feeling very unpleasant because he's just been turned on his head, and he feels giddy as a result of this. But there they are, and they're at the midpoint of the 19th century. They are more or less looking back on human history. Now, let us say, for the sake of argument, that human history is a straight line progress right up to where they are. Let's say that there has been a dialectic development, whether idealistic or materialistic, that has constantly produced a higher level of civilization as we move to the mid-19th century. Now that would be an appalling, gratuitous assumption, eh? I mean, we cheerfully recognize that isn't the way history moves anyway, and you'd have to determine what you meant by progress in particular areas of life. You can have bigger and better bathtubs, and yet lousier and lousier poetry. I mean, it depends upon what aspect of life you're talking about. But let's say, for purposes of argument, we squunch it all together good, and we say that it is a straight line progress, right up to that point. All right, that, of course, causes Hegel, who now feels better, to smile, because things are going the way he says that they are supposed to go. But neither Hegel nor Marx have any way of knowing what proportion of the total historical drama this much represents. Now, it could well be that there were four world historical epochs, and this is the Germanic. But how does anybody know that shortly thereafter human history is going to end? How does anybody know that human history is represented by this dotted line, for example? And let's say it were. Would it follow logically that there would have to be an extrapolation of this line representing progress? Surely not. Unless you can prove that always action is dialectic and always it involves the same kind of necessitarian upward movement. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that human history is not
that brief in its compass. Let's say that it continues as represented by the larger rectangle. It should be painfully obvious that though theoretically it could go like that, it certainly wouldn't have to. You could have all kinds of interesting variations on the whole thing, could you not? You know, to a colossal collapse at the end. The thing could end up in one hideous mess. You know, it could be the conclusion of one damn thing after another, even though at this point it didn't look that way. That's the human predicament, fundamentally, not being able to get enough perspective on the whole business. Because of that lack of perspective, the secular philosopher of history is making a gratuitous assumption. And let's see some of the elements that enter into this gratuitous assumption. Take the goals set for history. Kant's freedom, Kant's conception of reason, if we were to discuss him, Hegel's notion of freedom, Marx's classless society, Toynbee's ecumenical civilization. How are you going to demonstrate that they are necessitarian in character? Judgments as to what is significant and what is valuable are made constantly. Hegel's idealism, Marx's materialism, Spengler's favoring of instinct and agrarian society and reverence for tradition. There's a concept of human nature built into these conceptions. For example, Kant and Hegel and Toynbee all have an optimistic view of human nature. They feel that it's possible for human beings to reach the kind of ideal society under their own steam. Spengler holds a pessimistic view of human nature. Are these views able to be justified in any clean-cut sense? And there are ethical principles that are presupposed as well. For example, Hegel exempts history's great men from the ordinary standards of right and wrong. Marx allows the end to justify the means in bringing about the classless society through revolution. There are all kinds of fundamental concepts bristling in these systems which are unable to be justified because of the limited perspective of the people setting them forth. Now, I suggest, as I did at the beginning, that the problem here is not a lack of goodwill. It isn't that these people are dummies, or that in some sense they have not exercised enough skill in setting forth their viewpoint. In most instances, they are honestly trying to set forth the results of what they have had contact with, but they're attempting something for which they lack a sufficient perspective. Now suppose, for the sake of argument, we asked what the conditions would be for getting a total view of human history. What would be necessary in principle in order to determine where history is going? Clearly, it would be necessary to have a perspective on all of this. The reason that we're able to look at this board and delightfully contemplate the errors of past interpreters of history is that we stand outside the board. That's the advantage we have. Here we are outside of the board and looking in on it. Now, of course, if we were in that kind of a position relative to history, if we could look at the whole of it, then we'd be able to set forth a total philosophy of it. We could, for example, if this happened to be the pattern, and I trust it isn't, if we looked at this pattern from the outside, we could describe it and provide a universal philosophy of history that would actually represent what is the situation. Who is able to stand outside of human history and see the whole business? Well, clearly not the human beings who are in it. That would require the work of a god. A god would be necessary. Somebody outside of the pattern of history who is able to see the whole business.
It clearly would not do us a great deal of good if there were such a God. Let's say the God of philosophy of history, G.P.H., off somewhere, and he sees human history, and he has done an excellent work on the subject. You know, Human History by G.P.H., all right? Now, this would not do us a great deal of good if he had no contact with us, if this book were not locally published, if it were not available here within our frame of reference. Clearly, then, in order to get this kind of perspective, it would be necessary for him to dive in, if you will. He would have to enter history in order to give us an understanding of what it was all about. Now, this, of course, is precisely the claim of Christianity, that there was, if you will, an invasion from outer space, an invasion from outside human history into it. And at a point in history, the Lord of history entered it and presented himself, says the book of Acts, by many infallible proofs. And we tried to go into the nature of those proofs last night, particularly in reference to the historical evidence and the case in terms of legal evidence. This invasion, if it actually occurred, would in principle make it possible to get a perspective on the whole of history. And in the incarnation of Jesus Christ and his stamp of approval on the Bible, a particular philosophy of history is presented. And this philosophy of history has been characterized by Karl David, the German philosopher of history, as linear but centered. The Christian view of history is linear but centered. That is to say, it begins at a point, it ends at a point, and it has an interpretive center that makes sense out of the whole. The interpretive center is the incarnation, the entrance of God into history. It's the point of Jesus Christ, the point of the incarnation. And the drama begins with creation, and it ends with last judgment. What kind of a conception is this exactly? It says in the first place that things didn't come about by accident, but that they are the product of a divine and loving creative will. Says Jesus, not a sparrow falls from a tree without your heavenly Father knowing it. This infuses with value every historical event. None of it is a tale told by an idiot signifying nothing. It isn't bunk. It isn't one damn thing after another. It turns out to be a pattern in which everything has significance. The pattern, of course, is not evident at any given moment to the people locked into it. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a pattern there, nor does it mean that the pattern can't occasionally be seen. The great value of Thornton Wilder's writings is that he sees precisely this point. That's the point of the Bridge of San Luis Rey. That's even more the point of Wilder's Eighth Day, where the people locked into the history of this one family are unable to see what's actually happening in the family. But finally, at the end, the purpose becomes clear. And at the tail end of this, the leading character has contact with an Amish-like religious group, and the leader of this group reads the genealogies of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels. And the leader of this religious group says, "Do you suppose that any one of those generations leading up to Jesus knew exactly their place in the whole pattern? And yet, each one of those generations had a specific role to play, and there was a pattern." The Christian view of history says that history centers on Jesus Christ. That is to say, that there is a focal point, an event of overwhelming consequence, which can act as an interpretive guide to the rest. And that particular event is a redemptive event. Here we have God coming to earth to deal with the fundamental problem of the human condition. And what is that fundamental problem? That fundamental problem is sin. It's self-centeredness. It's the thing that got us into this human predicament to begin with. As a result of that self-centeredness, men are constantly attempting to consider their own existence and the existence of their own particular nation or historical unit as all important. Historical works are invariably colored by the kind of chauvinistic or nationalistic perspective that their writers have. Hegel is a perfect illustration of this kind of thing. And as a result of it, the human drama is skewed. It isn't seen in proper perspective. Interestingly enough, the medieval historians insisted on relating whatever they dealt with to the total biblical picture. Thus you get histories of medieval monasteries, which seem to us incredibly naive. The history of the monastery begins with the fall of man, and then goes on up to the redemption in Christ, and then finally, after these introductory chapters, you get to the specific history of the monastery. We consider that naive, but the point is quite obvious. For a medieval man, the particular monastery or the particular local history was not something that was all important. It was seen in a larger and universal perspective. It was understood as related to the total human drama. This is why, if you want to characterize medieval historiography, the one word for it is universal. It wasn't until the rise of the modern secular state that the creation of the chauvinistic type of history really entered. Then history finally comes to a last judgment. One of the most frustrating things about the historical drama is that it seems to leave so many loose ends. According to the biblical picture, there aren't going to be any loose ends finally. The things which were said in secret are going to be shouted to the housetops, and the whole business is going to be tied together. One of the great Christian philosophers of history at the very beginning of the modern secular era was Giambattista Vico, Vico in his Scienza Nuova. And in this work, Vico presents a view where each succeeding epoch of history acts as a judgment upon each previous epoch. It's like a series of concentric circles. God uses one epoch to judge the previous one, and finally, the outer circle is the last judgment, the judgment that finally places the capstone on the whole business. We, in our century, have seen how that kind of thing can work. We've seen how the demonic fascism of the Third Reich, the notion of a secular millennium, the creation of the thousand-year Reich, ended up in total destruction and a kingdom of a single generation. We've seen how that sort of thing created a historical judgment upon itself. The Christian notion of history, then, the biblical idea of history, is one in which the historical drama has specific meaning by direct relationship to the incarnation of Jesus Christ. You may well ask what significance this has for interpreting particular historical events. I haven't got the time to go into this, but I used in my book, The Shape of the Past, the French Revolution as a prototype example, and I dealt with the French Revolution in terms of this kind of conceptualization. If you want a far more significant example of that sort of thing, take a look sometime at Augustine's City of God, where Augustine uses this kind of conceptualization to speak of the fall of Rome. This sort of perspective has the benefit of a frame of reference which is not possible within the framework of secularism. And my final remark is simply that human life works the same way that history works. Human life is a microcosm of which human history is the macrocosm. And the same human predicament and the same lack of perspective on human life comes about when people try to work with it in a secular fashion. The same difficulties we've seen in the larger perspective here operate in each individual human life. If your life doesn't seem to make any sense, if you're having trouble figuring out how to make sense out of it, the problem is exactly this. You haven't got a sufficient perspective on the whole thing. And the same Jesus Christ who offers an answer to the meaning of history offers an answer to the meaning of your own life. He can be appropriated personally to take care of that problem as readily as he is willing to serve as a means of understanding the larger human drama. And I hope that you'll consider very seriously that as a possibility for you. Thank you. For the benefit of any professional historians who are here this evening, I hope you recognize that it was necessary to cover quite a bit of material in a short time. And if you'd like footnote references and a little less humor, you can easily find both in the stuff that I've written on the subject. As a student, I sat through enough appallingly dull lectures that I resolved a long time ago that I would prevent that from happening if I possibly could when I lectured. So if you felt that some of my illustrations lack dignity, the purpose of this was to provide greater interest, even though there might be a bit of loss from the standpoint of traditional academic style. All right, we'll go ahead with questions, and these questions can relate to any one of the sessions that we've had here or to other problems related to the subjects we've discussed. Yes?
Why is it that, or what is it doing to the audience and historians move from the perspective of the historians to the universal perspective to the secular perspective of the
universe? Yeah. The question, why did this change in perspective occur in historiography from the medieval approach to the nature of things to the modern view? Of course, there are innumerable factors involved in this, and really this turns out to be a special case of the more general question as to why things became secular. Because, of course, the modern secular interpretations of history are a manifestation of the modern secular era. They're just one aspect of it, just as philosophy of history is but one aspect of the general question of the meaning of life. 18th century man thought that he had suddenly discovered overwhelming reasons against traditional Christian interpretation of life. In the first lecture yesterday, I talked about Thomas Paine's Age of Reason, in which he presents criticisms of the Bible and a view which has come to be called deism, a counter-religion to that of Christianity. As we look at these arguments against Christianity presented in the 18th century, at the beginning of the modern secular era, unless we are compelled to support a secular viewpoint no matter what, if, in other words, we keep cool and look at these arguments in as objective a way as we can, I think we're amazed that they seem to have the effect they did. We look, for example, at Hume's argument against the miraculous, to which I referred this afternoon. Hume's argument against the miraculous, which still fascinates critics of religion, is a perfectly circular argument. If you happen to assume that there is uniform experience against the miraculous, why, my goodness, there are no miracles, because that's what we mean by universal experience, contrary to the miraculous. But the original question is still left. That hasn't been answered at all. Is there a uniform experience against the miraculous? If we take the arguments of secularism in the 18th century at its beginnings, we're amazed that these arguments don't really carry the apparent weight that they were thought to carry. And that suggests that the shift is not on the basis of such arguments. These arguments are not reasons for the shift. They are rationalizations for something that was already occurring. And unless I'm very much mistaken, one of the major reasons for the shift was not directly ideological. At the time of the French Revolution, which is the key transition point here, we find that the established church very largely aligns itself with the privileged establishment. And when inevitably the collapse comes, because you can't keep screwing the lid down on the unfortunate forever, when finally the explosion occurs, the people who have seen the evils of the establishment and who try to correct these evils discover the church to be aligned with the privileged structures. And the church gets carried down the drain along with the privileged structures. I think that one of the chief reasons for the rise of modern secularism was the great mistake that organized Christianity made in not maintaining the prophetic function that we have in the Bible. In the Bible, Christianity doesn't ally itself with a particular sociological mindset or a particular style in society. It stands in judgment above all such societies. But after the establishment of Christianity as the state religion, the time of Constantine, and the alignment of Christianity with the established structures, the time eventually came, of course, when these structures had become fundamentally unjust and the explosion took place and people could not believe that Christianity wasn't simply a means of supporting the repression that had occurred earlier. I think if we look at it this way, we can understand why people were impressed by the weakest kind of arguments that were presented in the 18th century. People felt that there had to be something the matter with Christianity, and so they would readily accept most any argument against it. And the secular philosophies of history are part of that general trend. Christianity stands with precisely the same evidence in its behalf that it's always had. As C.S. Lewis pointed out in Screwtape Letters, Uncle Screwtape, our elder devil down in hell, likes to have new biographies of Jesus written every fall. There's the anti-vivisectionist Jesus. There is the revolutionary Jesus. There is the vegetarian Jesus. New Jesuses every fall, because in point of fact, the only way to get people away from the truth of Christianity is to divert them from the documents which have remained the same since the first century and which present exactly the same evidence in behalf of a Jesus who claimed to be God Almighty and rose again from the dead to vindicate it. Says Uncle Screwtape, the only way we can create these is by depressing the evidence at one point and raising it again at another, because the evidence is always the same. Yes?
I certainly appreciate your success in proving and destroying our sort of closet prophecy. So there are always an element of prediction or prophecy in each system. And because progressivism, or the concept of progress, is so ingrained in the modern world in these various methods, I was just wondering, do you feel there's a place for sort of Christian pessimism relative to secular history? I'm thinking in terms of Burkhardt. In other words, God's intervention in history at various points tends to render it